This is the Education Gadfly Show.
The moral of the story is pineapples don't have sleeves.
Which is so
How
cool.
is that a moral?
Now, here's your host.
Hello, this is your host, Janie Scull of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the most recent man to drop out of the Republican presidential campaign, Rick Hess.
Hey, how you doing, Jenny?
Good, how are you?
Good, so Gingrich is out, huh?
That's what I hear. That's what my sources tell me.
It seemed like he was so close just last week.
Did it?
No, not really.
No. All right, well, we've got a lot to cover today. We've got Amber's research minute later on, and we've got Ty now with Pardon the Gadfly.
Yesterday, the Fordham Institute released a new volume on digital learning, Education Reform for the Digital Era, which, Rick, you wrote a chapter for. So what are three things policymakers need to do to make sure digital learning doesn't repeat the mistake of the charter school movement?
I think there's a lot more than three things it needs to do. I mean, for me, it comes down to two kind of overarching things, which are largely just funding and accountability, because the way that those both of those are structured right now, it doesn't allow for little pieces and little, you know, providers to come in and provide small services. There's just no way that we can hold them accountable the way the school system is structured right now. And there's no way that we can really pay them in a way that, you know, they get the small fraction of per pupil spending for whatever services they're providing. So for me, it's kind of unbundling both of those. It's breaking apart funding to be able to pay providers for the small portion of a child's education that they're providing, and then also to be able to hold them accountable for the small portion that they're providing, which I know is rather general, but.
Yeah, no, I think those are right. I mean, right, I mean, for me, the biggest mistake of charter schooling was the notion that somehow if you brought charters into the space, that they would transform existing districts through competition, or that charters themselves would be able to transform the way we think and talk about teaching and learning, despite all of the other impediments and frustrations and rules and regs that still apply. And, you know, when you look even at promising digital ventures like Florida Virtual, when you think about how tightly they've been wound into the familiar routines, the way they hire staff, the people who teach, the way that we think about the teacher's role, the way it plugs into the school day, you know, the opportunities here to really, like you said, unbundle or unwind what we're used to doing and approach it different are remarkably limited. So the trick is to understand that technology, you know, is a tool, but really what really matters is whether we create the conditions and whether we use that tool wisely or well. And way too many enthusiasts about technology, just like they worry about charter schooling, can give the impression that technology is going to take care of this all by itself.
Well, you mentioned Florida Virtual School, but what's so great about that as opposed to other virtual providers right now? I mean, what are
mostly,
they doing right?
Mostly just size. No, I mean, that's the interesting thing, right? Florida Virtual is still basically hiring and evaluating teachers just the way you would if you were a brick and mortar district. So, you know, you get 13, 14 years downstream, you'd like to think that you've started to rethink the work of teaching when you're only providing online instruction, probably means different requirements in terms of skills, different challenges in terms of discipline and the rest. But that's, you know, we are very much bundled into thinking about technology is a substitute for the regular things that we always do, rather than an opportunity to go back and rethink how we actually approach teaching and learning.
Yeah, I think that's the larger point, is that it's not just something that we're adding into the same way that we've already been doing it. It really is a way to completely just start from the ground up and kind of restart and, you know.
Well, it's an opportunity to.
Yeah.
No. Just like charters were.
Yeah.
When we saw how I have generally not been thrilled with how that's played out.
So hopefully this will go better. All right, Ty, question two.
The School District of Philadelphia proposed shutting 40 district schools by next fall as part of an effort to close a $218 million budget deficit. Is Philly in trouble, or does this plan have promise?
Yes. I mean, Philly's in huge trouble.
Yeah, clearly.
You know, one of the first, you know, the first rule of holes is stop digging. So, you know, when you're running a $200+ million deficit, starting to shutter underutilized schools is a, you know, useful and reasonable place to start. And so, at best, you know, the first step in a very long march.
Yeah, but at the same time, this plan doesn't have too many details laid out right now. And as much as it has potential, it also could go awry, I think. I mean,
oh, yeah.
I would certainly be concerned if I was a parent and all the schools near me were closing. And, you know, I have a right to having a good school nearby. And I think
that's the nice thing about vague plans. They have
promise. Exactly.
Right? The promise tends to dissipate when you realize the plan is poorly conceived.
Yes.
And we don't know yet.
Yeah, although there was one element of this which I think was, you know, kind of a strike against it, is that they're looking at, I think, cutting 7% of funding just for charter schools as another way to cut costs. And that to me is like, you know, the whole theme of the move is, I think it was the school's chief there said something like, we want to start thinking about, you know, not the school district of Philadelphia, but public schools in Philly. And if that's true, then you can't just take a certain type of school and say, all right, we're going to slash your funding and no one else's. Like, that's just, to me, kind of an asinine move.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is when, you know, when you got a $200 million shortfall, you got to cut everywhere.
Well, that's the thing. You got to cut everywhere. You can't just cut charter schools. I mean, they're already, I mean, I don't know specifically in Philadelphia, but I would assume they're already getting less than public schools. So if you're shuttering public schools because they're not drawing students, then why would you still be maintaining their funding? All right. Question three.
All right. A story about a sleeveless pineapple on a New York standardized assessment ignited a firestorm over high stakes testing this week. What lessons do ed reformers need to learn from Pineapplegate?
Not to write stories about pineapples talking. Yeah, it's a, for anyone who hasn't read it, it's a completely ridiculous story. We'll have a dramatic reading of it at the end of the podcast for anyone who wants to stick around, but we won't subject you to that now. It's basically about a hare and a pineapple in a race, and the pineapple doesn't move, so everyone who bet on the pineapple gets mad and eats them, and then it asks for kind of the moral of the story is pineapples don't have sleeves because the pineapple didn't have a trick up its sleeve, and the whole thing is as ridiculous as it sounds. But at the end of the day, I think it just shows that, you know, we really do need, if we're going to be pushing school, you know, accountability of teachers and students through student testing, we're going to have to get accountable on the tests as well. And we can't just have ridiculous questions that really have no meaning behind them and aren't proving intelligence in any way. We really need something that actually measures student achievement, which, you know, sounds obvious, but it's hard to do when you don't have any oversight over Pearson and whoever else is actually making the tests.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's also a question of, you know, this unfettered faith in assessment. You know, you just, I mean, even, you know, just talking about it, right? You said, well, testing of intelligence, you kind mm-hmm. of slipped, right? But, right, we're not supposed to be testing intelligence,
true.
Right? We're supposed to be testing mastery of content.
Yes, true.
But exactly what constitutes mastery of content is actually an interesting question on something like English language arts. So, you know, we've been told that, well, the Common Core is being handed off to these brilliant psychometricians who are going to design the right questions and the 47,000 items for SPAC, and they're going to calibrate it just so. I got to tell you, I mean, you know, the notion that we can actually nail down with that kind of precision the exact right battery of questions to gauge whether students have learned what they're supposed to learn at a point in time is, I think, something which is an article of faith for modern mm-hmm. school reform. But I think, you know, like so many other efforts to bring precision to really complex and uncertain human events, you know, it hides and kind of ignores as much of the yuckiness, you know, as it possibly can.
Well, I don't think anyone would argue that these tests are ever going to be perfect, just like no one argues that value-added measures are ever going to be perfect and should be, you know, the sole way that we measure, you know, for teacher, you know, performance, for example. But I do think that it is probably the best way that we can measure student performance. And if we're, you know, as such, we should focus as much as we can on obviously making it a good measure. And if that means adding some sort of level of accountability into the actual writing of questions, because, you know, they're not like standards. You don't write them once and then just move on and use them forever. Like, you have to rewrite them every couple of years or every year, maybe, depending on how you're going to administer the test. Like, it needs some sort of someone saying, this is okay, this isn't.
But like this pineapple, right? So this turns out it was Daniel Pinkwater, who's a fabulous writer, right? Lizard Music and, you know, so much wonderful stuff. Alan Mendelsohn, The Boy from Mars. It's actually, I mean, I hadn't read it until y'all just showed it to me. It's a fabulous little story.
Well, it's actually very different from what he wrote, and he's really not happy with it.
Okay.
Or he's just coming out and saying, look, I didn't write this. They took a blurb of mine. It was, his was about an eggplant and an old man kind of telling a young kid a story, I think.
And, you know, the thing is, though, that the questions in these are always actually about, like, reading comprehension, for instance. Mm-hmm. So the actual substance of what the piece of guided reading is, you know, in some ways matters a lot less than kind of the question you asked. And as Diane Ravitch pointed out, you know, about a dozen years ago in her Language Police book, you know, frankly, our ability to actually do real or meaningful passages of reading for these things is hugely limited because of all of the, you know, you're not allowed to's around, you know, the topics and subjects and words. So,
but the moral of the story is pineapples don't have sleeves.
Which is so
How
cool.
is that a moral? That I don't think the author understood what a moral really
was. Was it one of the questions that actually asked what's the moral of the story?
No, it literally stated.
Yeah, I saw that.
The end of the,
but that's
the
a cute,
story.
But that's a cute moral.
It's
moral.
Not a moral.
No, it's not. It's kind
I
of
mean,
a funny.
You could argue with the fact from the story, but it's really not even a fact.
It's dry humor.
The question was, why did the animals eat the pineapple? So I don't know how much deeper that goes.
All right, well, I think that's all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. Thanks for coming out, Ty. Up next is Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Janie.
How you doing?
I'm doing great.
Do we have something good and interesting this week to liven up this conversation?
Has it been boring? Yes. Well, I'm sorry.
Bring the heat, Amber. Let's see.
Came in late. All right. New report out by Public Impact. We like Public Impact, right? Examining student-based budgeting, otherwise known as weighted student funding, in Hartford Public Schools. You seen this study, Rick?
I don't believe so.
All right. Anyway, they looked at school budget data from 04 to 11. They interviewed a bunch of school principals. Hartford's got Adam Nowski in there, sort of hard-hitting, reform-oriented guy. He basically came in with an input-based model, like most school districts use, using staff positions, materials, blah, blah, blah. Decided to change to a weighted student funding model that sort of uses student enrollment and weights, gives kids different weights based on their needs. The result, researchers found that SBB is what they call it, made it so that schools get similar amounts for similar kids. Shocking, that was the whole point of the thing. And principals say it is fair, but 69% of them also receive more funding than they did under the old formula. But turns out the new model has some drawbacks, which were kind of hard to find. They were a little bit buried. Anyway, the district charges schools for teacher salaries based on their average teacher salary. So that means that veteran teachers are charged less than what the district actually pays to employ them and vice versa. So it basically means that schools with new teachers receive funding below the SBB amount. And the district's afraid that if they change that, then the schools are going to just hire all new people, you know, so they can get more money. Second, about 30% of the budget is special funding, which is not distributed via SBB, which means, for instance, that magnet schools still get a boatload more money. Third, the district has a hold harmless clause so that schools will not be put out of business if they have declining enrollment. To wit, in 2010-11, schools with fewer than 260 students were eligible for an extra $265,000 each. Finally, though, the budget numbers are transparent, which was the whole thing of this. The reconciliation from the actual to the budgeted amount is not available to the public. So, I don't know. Fordham's kind of a weighted student funding advocate, that hearken to say, if Petrilli was here. I got to say, this report, and we've seen other people, Hannah Sheck and others, voice some concerns about weighted student funding, and this definitely falls into that category of be very suspicious. It's not going to solve all our equitability problems if that's what we're trying to solve.
Well, it didn't sound like it was really commenting on the equitability of it, though, more so just the structure of this particular one and kind of how it's structured is possibly causing some issues.
Yeah, but I think the issues that it brought up are actually common issues, especially how schools are charged with the average teacher salary. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty common. At least that's been my experience.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, this is, you know, so it sounds like by the time you get through the weighted student funding thing, right? I mean, the actual degrees of difference from traditional staffing and funding models are pretty damn minimal.
Yeah. Well, especially when you've got almost 70% of the kids, I mean, the schools are getting more money. So I think we thought, okay, this is sort of right-sizing. At least that's sort of all been, I don't know. I think some people think that way. And right-sizing is code for you get less. But no, it's not the case here. So
yeah, I mean, and frankly, I mean, if you're assigning average teacher salaries, for instance, that's actually indistinguishable from traditional assigning of FTEs. So right. If you say to a school, you've got 400 kids, therefore you get, you know, 37 FTEs in an elementary, mm-hmm. or you say to a school, you've got 400 kids, you get 37 FTEs, each FTEV is funded at an average level of X, it makes zero difference. Right. It's the same thing. So the idea that this is somehow, you know, changing the dynamics of decision makers is, I think, oversold.
But then I think it's also oversold to even call this weighted student fund.
Yes.
Because it's not. It's like,
is it different from, I mean, maybe I'm putting, is it the same thing? Student-based budgeting? That was a new word to me.
Sounds
is it the same thing?
Well, this is where you get into jargon land.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, I mean, because they never called it that, but I'm reading it and I'm like, why aren't they calling it that?
Yeah.
I guess, I don't know.
No, I mean, this is, right? And it's just, you know, it's so transparently kind of flim-flimmy. Mm-hmm. Because actually, look, if younger teachers are as effective as more senior teachers and are cheaper, if you're actually a student-centered organization, you should hire more younger teachers.
Right.
Because you can hire more of them for the same money. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be good for kids. If older teachers are better than younger teachers, then paying more for them makes sense. But the idea, you know, but like in a lot of organizations, you have 35-year-olds who work side by side with 55-year-olds, and they make about the same money if they've got similar responsibilities. So yeah. Part of the problem here is the notion that just because you're an older teacher, you should necessarily cost a lot more. It is actually a problem that wage and funding should help us solve.
Oh, right. Well, and the fact that you're, and the other idea is if you lose students, hey, that's incentive to change what you're doing mm-hmm. and get better. And they've just taken that away by saying you get held harmless. If you happen to lose students, we're going to give you some money. I'm like, you're right. Just defeating the whole purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, depressing study, but, you know, useful. Interesting. Public cool. impact does good work. And kudos to Hartford for actually wanting to have a study like this done.
Nice.
So there you have it.
Nice job, Amber.
Great. Well, thanks for coming on the show, Amber.
You're welcome.
That's all we have for this week. Until next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Janie Scull, the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.
And now, a dramatic reading of The Hare and the Pineapple by Daniel Pinkwater.
In olden times, the animals of the forest could speak English just like you and me. One day, a pineapple challenged a hare to a race. I forgot to mention fruits and vegetables were able to speak too. A hare is like a rabbit, only skinnier and faster. This particular hare was known to be the fastest animal in the forest. "You, a pineapple, have the nerve to challenge me, a hare, to a race?" the hare asked the pineapple. "This must be some sort of joke." "No," said the pineapple. "I want to race you 26 miles, and may the best animal win." "You aren't even an animal," the hare said. "You're a tropical fruit." "Well, you know what I mean," the pineapple said. The animals of the forest thought it was very strange that a tropical fruit should want to race a very fast animal. "The pineapple has some trick up its sleeve," a moose said. "Pineapples don't have sleeves," an owl said. "Well, you know what I mean," the moose said. "If a pineapple challenges a hare to a race, it must be that pineapple knows some secret trick that will allow it to win. The pineapple probably expects us to root for the hare and then look like fools when it loses," said a crow. "Then the pineapple will win the race because the hare is overconfident and takes a nap or gets lost or something." The animals agreed that this made sense. There was no reason a pineapple should challenge a hare unless it had a clever plan of some sort. So the animals, wanting to back a winner, all cheered for the pineapple. When the race began, the hare sprinted forward and was out of sight in less than a minute. The pineapple just sat there, never moving an inch. The animals crowded around, watching to see how the pineapple was going to cleverly beat the hare. 2 hours later, when the hare crossed the finish line, the pineapple was still sitting still and hadn't moved an inch. The animals ate the pineapple. Moral: pineapples don't have sleeves.